Book of Judges Uncensored, Episode 7. So we're in towards the end of chapter Yud Beis, chapter 12 in the Book of Judges. And we're up last thing we saw was Yiftach. And Yiftach was a judge for 6 years and then he died. And now we're up to the judge after him. This is the 10th judge. Vayishbein Achrav es Yisrael, Ivtzan mi Beis Lechem. After Yiftach, the judge over the Jewish people, his name was Ivtzan, and he was from a place called Bethlehem. Vayehi loy shleishim banim, and he had 30 sons, with shleishim banis, and he had 30 daughters. And he married his 30 sons and he met to other families, and he married up his 30 daughters to people from other families. And it says that he was a judge over the Jewish people for 7 years. And it says that Ivtzan died, and then he was buried in Beis Lechem.
How old was this guy when he died?
How old was this guy when he died? Okay, that's one question. Any other questions?
Yeah, assuming he was older than 120, why do we give people the bracha to be lived to 120? So we know people could live past 120.
So Rav Moshe finds the first of all. Let's assume that because we'll see how old he was when he died. But Rav Moshe Feinstein actually disagrees with it, with the popular custom of saying like until 120. He's saying why limit the guy to 120? It doesn't really say anywhere that a person is only going to live to 120. I mean, it sort of says it in Parshas Bereishis that Hashem wanted to limit people's lifespan from like the outrageous numbers that you find earlier. But then you see that also didn't happen because people still lived over 120. So
I guess I mean, it should say you live like most.
Could be. Okay.
So what? You live to 120?
Okay, so let's take it slowly. Who, first of all, this Ivtzan person, our Shofet Ivtzan, it doesn't really say much about him. It just says that he was a Shofet for 7 years, he had 30 sons and 30 daughters, and he's from Beis Lechem, and he was buried in Beis Lechem. That's all the facts that we know about him in the book of, in Sefer Shoftim. Now, Chazal tell us, in Maseches Bava Basra, Daf Tzadik Aleph Amar Aleph, that Ivtzan is another name for a character that we're familiar with from elsewhere in Tanakh. It says, I'm trying to look for the exact expression. Yeah, Amar Rabba Bar Huna Amar Rav Ivtzan Ze Boaz. Ivtzan is Boaz. Okay, so Chazal in the Gemara and Bava Basra say that Ivtzan is Boaz. So now we know that Boaz is from the tribe of Yehuda, which we'll get to. So now we know a little bit more about Ivtzan. Ivtzan is from the tribe of Yehuda. But who's Boaz? Where do we know about Boaz? So there's a whole book where Boaz is the hero, right? The book of Rus, Megillas Rus, where Boaz is the major hero of that book. So I was thinking that we would sort of go through that story over there in Megillas Rus in abbreviated fashion, and then we can start discussing this idea that Ivtzan is Boaz and different questions that are associated with the assertion that Ivtzan is Boaz, and seeing, you know, is there room to say that maybe Ivtzan is not Boaz? It could be a subject to controversy. That's what I'm saying.
I'm just wondering how he managed to have 60 children.
Oh. So we'll get.
I don't feel like that's such a big
challenge. Okay.
I mean, it is, but it's not like impossible.
So the book of Ruth starts like this. It says, "Vayhi b'mei shfayt hashayftim." It was in the days that the judges had judged. Right. So that already sets the chronology and says that Megillas Ruth is in the time of Shoftim. So we're talking about the right time period, more or less. Right. Chazal have a drush over here. They say Shvot Hashoftim, that the judges had judged. That it means that the people would judge their judges. Like the people were critical of their leaders in that way. They would look at their leaders and start judging the leaders. They're judging the judges and figuring out, you know, are the judges doing properly or not.
The judges were judged.
Well, right, the judges were judged, not had judged. Yeah. So it says Megillas Rus begins. It starts off with a man leaving Beis Lechem. A man named Elimelech, and his wife Naomi, and his two sons Machlon and Kilion, and they left Beis Lechem because there was a famine in Eretz Yisrael. So they left Beis Lechem, which was in Yehuda, and they went to live in the Moabite territory. it's interesting, it calls them Ephrasim. They're called Ephrasim. So the term Ephras has two meanings. It can either mean a person from the tribe of Ephraim, like we saw last week in the previous episode, we saw that Yiftach was killing out the people from Ephraim. So one of the things that he would ask is, are you an Ephrasi or Ephrati? Are you an Ephrati or Ephrasi? That means you're from Ephraim. But the term Ephrasi also means from the place of Ephrat. Ephrat is another name for Beis Lachem. So it's also a name of a family in the tribe of Yehuda. So like the term Ephrasi, every time you see it, you have to know if it's talking about someone from Ephraim, or is it talking about someone from Beis Lachem, which is from Yehuda. Anyways, so Elimelech and his wife Naomi and his two sons Mahlon and Kilion, they leave Beis Lachem and they go to a place, they go live in Moab. And it says that Elimelech's two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, married Moabite women. One married Orpah and one married Ruth, and they lived in the land of Moab for 10 years. Now it says that after that, it says that Elimelech died, and Mahlon and Chilion died, and basically what happened is you're left with three widows. You have Naomi, who's Elimelech's widow, and then you have Ruth and Orpah, who are Mahlon and Kilion's widows. So it says that after the so it says that afterwards, Naomi decided that she's going to come back to Eretz Yisrael, right? So she wants to bring with her two daughters-in-law want to come with her. And basically, she tries to dissuade them from coming with her. She says, no, why don't you stay there? Stay in the land of Moab. You're Moabite women. You're not necessarily Jewish women. Stay over there. Why do you want to bother coming with me? So basically, in the end, what happens is that her daughter-in-law, Orpah, returns back to Moab. But her daughter-in-law, Ruth, remains persistent and says, no, she wants to stay with her. And you know, she says the famous words, no, wherever you go, I go. Wherever you're going to sleep, or I'm going to sleep. Your nation is my nation. Your God is my God. I'm with you. So Ruth sticks with her mother-in-law, with Naomi. And Ruth and Naomi comes back to Beis Lachem, and people are like astounded. Like, you know, who is this? Who is this Naomi? Why does she look so? She looks so downtrodden. Because you know her son and her sons had died and her husband had died and you know, they didn't know what to do with her, and she said, oh, don't call me Naomi anymore, call me Mara, call me the embittered person, because Hashem brought me all these misfortunes. What people started calling her Mara, I don't know.
Like, can you just, you can't start your own nickname,
right? I mean, to get a picture of what was happening here a little bit better. So Chazal tells us that Elimelech was one of the important people of his generation. He was one of the gadol adars in his generation, and he was also, you know, he was very rich, and he was very, in a leadership position. And because there was a famine, he decided that instead of, you know, taking responsibility during this famine and helping support the less fortunate Jewish people, he would instead just, you know, pack up and leave Eretz Yisrael and go to Moab, where things would be a little bit better off for him, right? So because he like shirked on that responsibility to the Jewish people, so that's why he ended up dying and his children ended up dying. Like, that was the punishment. His whole family ended up, you know, they didn't step up to the plate when they were expected to take charge. So basically, the Chazal tell us that Elimelech was a son of Nachshon ben Aminadav from the tribe of Yehuda, who is the first person to jump into the sea by the splitting of the Red Sea. And Chazal tell us that Elimelech had a brother named Salmon, and he had another brother who remains anonymous. He's called Ploni Almoni, the anonymous guy, Mr. Anonymous, John Doe. And so Elimelech had a brother named Salmon, and Salmon had a son named Boaz. So Boaz was Elimelech's nephew. Right, so when Naomi and her daughter-in-law Ruth came back to Eretz Yisrael, they came back to Beis Lachem. So Naomi told Ruth that she should go out to the field and there's a halacha that if a person is harvesting and they drop one or two stalks of grain, so they're supposed to leave it there, right? It's called leket, right? You're supposed to leave it there, and then poor people are allowed to come and take it. Or if you forget a bundle in the field when you're bringing the bundles inside, so you have to leave it there, and the poor people are allowed to come take it. So the way that the poor people got their, you know, made their parnasa was they would go out to the fields and, you know, pick up after the mistakes of the other people. Right, just follow them around and wait for them to make a mistake. Yeah, so Naomi sent Ruth to go out and do this, take advantage of this social safety net that the Jewish people had in place, and then, you know, that would give parnasa to Naomi and to Ruth. So basically, what happens is that Ruth goes out to do this, and she happens upon the field of Boaz, and Boaz takes a special liking to Ruth. He sees that she's very tzanua, that she's very modest, and that she keeps exactly to the laws of leket. Like, she doesn't, if there were three stalks, so you're allowed to pick it back up. The person who dropped it is allowed to pick it back up. You don't have to leave it for the poor people. But if it's one or two, then you have to leave it. So some of the poor people were not as scrupulous in following the halakhas. And if there were three stalks, they would also take it. Even though they're only allowed to take it if it's one or two. So Ruth was very careful, you know, how much she would take, when she would take it. So Boaz took a special, paid attention to her. So it says that Boaz came to his field, and he said to his harvesters, he said, Hashem imachem. Oh, he greets them, he says, Hashem should be with you. And they answer back, Yevarecha Hashem, Hashem, you know, should bless you. And he sees, like, he's a lady, he's like, who is this lady over here? You know, she's a tzanua, she's modest, and she's keeping to the halachas very closely. So they told her, oh, she's the Moabite woman who is Naomi's daughter-in-law, that she came back with Naomi from the land of Moab. So basically, Boaz takes a special liking to her, and he tells her that, you know, stay over here, hang out in my field. I'm going to give them special orders. I'm going to give my servants and the people working in my field special orders not to bother you. And I'll give you water. I'll let you take water from my field, from all the things that my servants have drawn. And I'll let you get your parnasa from, you know, just from my field. You don't have to, like, go around and, you know, try to scrape up the different things that you find in the other fields. So she says to him, why do you like me so much? What did I do? And he says, well, I've been told all the nice things that you've been doing to my aunt Naomi, that you're helping her out and you're staying with her. You never left her, so I'm repaying you because I'm letting you do this. And then it says that he even told his servants to drop extra things so that she can have some extra, she can get some extra wheat, not just the regular mistakes, but just even added things. So she comes back to Naomi and she shows Naomi all this, you know, all this grain that she was able to harvest from the thing. And Naomi's like, oh, where'd you get all of this? And he told her, oh, I went to the field of Boaz, and Boaz was so gracious, and, you know, he helped me out, and I was able to, you know, reap all these benefits from it. So basically what happens is that Naomi comes up with a plan that she wants Boaz, who's their relative, to take responsibility for her family and to buy back the fields that they had sold when they were poor, and to maybe perhaps marry Ruth. So she sends Ruth to go meet Boaz in the middle of the night when he was spending the night over in his granary by himself, and she goes to lay down next to him, and she offers herself over to Boaz that he should marry her. Chazal tell us that the day that Boaz, that Naomi and Ruth came to Eretz Yisrael, the day that Ruth and Naomi came back to Eretz Yisrael, Boaz's wife happened to die. So Boaz is a single guy now. The Chazal tell us that he was either 80 years old, some sources say he was 300 years old or 400 years old. So that speaks to your question, Shimon. Yeah, young man. And his wife is dead, and the Chazal tells us that he doesn't have any children.
He has multiple wives. Then 60 children is much more plausible.
Well, let's see what happens.
You know, like, if people are living to like 400 or whatever, then 100 years old really isn't that old.
So it says that he was either 80 or 300 or 400 years old, and he didn't have any children, and his wife had died the day that they came from back to Eretz Yisrael. So he's left with Ruth alone in the middle of the night, and he refrains from doing anything with her. what he ends up doing is he tells her, look, we'll go tomorrow morning to the court, and you know the reason why I don't want to commit right now to buying back the fields and marrying you is because there's a closer relative who really the responsibility should go on him, and if he doesn't take that the responsibility, so then I'll marry you, right? Because we said that Boaz's father Salmon, right, he was brothers with Elimelech, and there was another brother, the Mr. Anonymous, right? All three of them were sons of Nachshon ben Aminadab. Chazal also tells us actually that Naomi's father was also one of the brothers, so there's really a fourth brother.
Nachshon ben Aminadab
was a good guy.
He was a very good guy.
He was a good guy, yeah, very good guy. He was the first one to jump into the sea by the Red Sea.
Oh,
he was.
The sea split when it went up.
He was the Nasi of the tribe of Yehuda. Okay. So he's a good guy. So what happens is that they go the next day to the court, and it says that Boaz is sitting in the gate of the city, and he sees his uncle, who's the closer relative, Mr. Anonymous, who Chazal tells that could be, some sources say that his name was Tov. It doesn't say it explicitly in the text, but some say that his name was Tov, and Boaz says to Tov, or Mr. Anonymous, he says, not the hacker Anonymous, no, it's a different guy.
Okay.
Yeah. So he tells him, you know, we have this family over here. Your brother Elimelech, he died, and his family is very downtrodden and poor, and they sold their field, and his daughter-in-law is a widow, and she needs someone to marry her. You know, are you willing to step up to the plate and buy back the fields? And you know, bring back their family and to marry this lady Rus. Now I was always bothered by why does the girl and the field go together, but that's just I guess one of the assumptions over here. Maybe if I look in the Mefarshim and Rus, I would get a better understanding. But so you're saying, are you willing to buy back the fields and marry Rus or not? And the Mr. Anonymous says, I can't do it. Lo yuchal ligol pen ashchis es nachlasi, because I don't want to corrupt my inheritance. Chazal tell us that, you know, the Torah outlaws marrying a Moabite. Lo yavoy amoni Moavi b'kal Hashem. A Moabite and Ammonite may not enter the congregation of Hashem, of the Lord, right? So that seems to say you're not allowed to marry a Moabite, right? So this Mr. Anonymous is saying, I don't want to marry this lady because, you know, she's a Moabite. We're not really allowed to marry into the Moabites. But we know that there's a tradition that tells us that it says Lo yavoy Ammoni u'Moavi b'kal Hashem. An Ammoni and a Moavi can't join the congregation of Hashem, which is in masculine form, Ammoni and Moavi, as opposed to feminine form, which would be Ammonit, Ammonis, or Moavis, a female Moavite or a female Ammonite. So Chazal tell us that the prohibition of marrying an Ammonite or a Moavite only applies for a Jewish woman marrying a male person from Ammon or Moab. But for a Jewish man to marry a female member of Ammon or Moab is not a problem.
I wonder what happens if a Jewish woman marries a Moabite. Does the kid like still Jewish, or is it like a halal or something?
If a Jewish woman marries Ammonite or Moabite,
yeah.
So the kid is normally is Jewish and everything is okay technically, except that I think he retains his status of Ammonite or Moabite. I'm not sure. I think he retains that status, but he's still Jewish. There's no such halacha that a person from Ammon or Moab can't convert to Judaism. That's not the halacha. The halacha is that they can't marry into the mainstream Jewish family.
Right, so if they convert into Judaism, can their kids?
So I believe that not, because the status continues from generation to generation. Unless I don't remember exactly if it goes from mother or from the father, but it could be that if they're allowed to marry, let's say a ger, right? Ammoni is allowed to marry a ger, so then it could be that you can get rid of it from if the father is a ger, let's say there wouldn't be a problem because the woman, the Ammoni, would be a female. In short, Boaz knew this halacha, that the prohibition only applies to marrying male members of Amun Amov, not to marrying female members of Amun Amov. So he knew this halacha, and Mr. Anonymous, he was unsure about whether this halacha is true or not, and he didn't want to risk it, so he says, I'm not doing it. So Boaz says, okay, I know this halacha, I can do it, and he goes, and he marries Rus, and Chazal tell us that the night that he married her, he impregnated her, and then he himself died. And then it says that Rus had a son named Oved, and Oved had a son named Yishai, and Yishai had a son named David, and that's David HaMelech, right? And that's why we read Megillas Rus on Shavuos, because Shavuos was the day that David HaMelech died, so that's why, and Rus is the story of the background of David HaMelech's genealogy, so we read Rus on Shavuos.
Pretty rough time for Rus.
What?
Pretty rough time.
Pretty rough time.
Her husband dies, she goes back, and she meets someone whose wife's just died, marries him, and then he drops dead.
Well, it's interesting. Chazal tell us that Rus had a richas yom, she had longevity, and she lived all the way to the time of her grandson's grandson, to Shlomo Melech. And it says that Shlomo Melech actually made a special throne for her, that she was like, you know, the queen mother type of thing. So it's like, so she does end up seeing the glory that comes out of her, you know, in the end. Okay, so this is in a nutshell. This is the story of Megillas Rus. So there's a few questions that we have to sort of consider over here, because we said that the Gemara tells us that Ivtsan, the judge that we're talking about right now, is another name for Boaz. Right. So I have a question. I told you that Chazal, the Medrash, says that Boaz didn't have any sons, right? And yet, one of the only things we know about Ivtsan is that he had 30 sons and 30 daughters. So how does that jive? If Ivtsan is Boaz, how can you say on the one hand he doesn't have any kids, and on the other hand he had 30 sons and 30 daughters? So the Gemara actually addresses this issue, and the Gemara says that what happened was, where does this come up? The Gemara says, Boaz made 120 parties for his children. As Rashi explains, that he had 60 children altogether, right? 30 sons and 30 daughters. And for each of his 60 children, when they got married, he made two parties. One, I guess, we would sort of call it an engagement party, and one, the wedding party. So that's 120 parties altogether. And he made 120 parties, and with all these parties, he never invited Manoach. Tomorrow we're going to learn about Manoach. Manoach is going to be the father of Shimshon, Samson. We're going to learn about him tomorrow. But Boaz never invited Manoach to any of these parties, because Manoach was somebody who didn't have any kids. Okay? He was an Ochar. He was a person who didn't have any kids. So he said, Boaz reasoned, like, why should I invite this guy to my parties, to my kids' weddings and my kids' engagement parties? He's never going to invite me to his kids' weddings or engagement parties because he doesn't have any kids, so why should I bother inviting him?
That sounds like a very, I don't know, insensitive rationale for, like, one of the great leaders of...
Yeah. No, it's true. But when we're talking about great people, so there's greater expectations of them. So, therefore, we're more sensitive to their misfallings. Right? We're more sensitive to the places where they don't live up to what we expect of them. Chazal tells us, "B'svivam nisar amayin." Hashem is more meticulous when sort of judging the righteous, or we're judging the good people, because He expects more from them. So you're right. For a guy like Boaz, you know, this is a horrible thing that he did. For us, it sort of sounds a little bit petty. But, you know, it's sort of like, what, you only invite people because, like, you know, it's like the guy who, you know, I once saw an invitation, you know, for a wedding. It says, your presence are welcome.
Yeah.
Your presence with a T, you know? Your presence are welcome. Like, what, you're only inviting him because you want his presence? So,
an interesting character.
Well, we'll get to him. So Chazal tells us that he had a whole bunch of kids. He made 120 parties. Never invited Menach. Because of that, It says, actually it doesn't quite say that it was because of this, but it says, and all 60 of his kids died in his lifetime.
Well, maybe
well, that's really wrong. Maybe something to do with, maybe it doesn't actually mean literally that was the rationale, but maybe it was
maybe it was part of what he put into consideration, and you know that it wasn't a major part of the consideration, but because he did think like that in some way, so then he was punished for it. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, or like they do the same thing with like David. They paint it out to be like a really bad thing, and then like Amaro will like actually explain that like it's not what it meant in the
body. Right. So okay. So that answers that question. Right? He said, how could Boaz be Ibsen? Ibsen had a bunch of kids and Boaz didn't have any kids. So he said, yeah, he had them and then they died. Another question. There's a Gemara in Mesechus Makos. The Gemara in Makos talks about different things that were instituted by Beis Din Shalmata, by the earthly court, and it was agreed to the heavenly court agreed to these ideas. And Gemara Makos Chaf Gimel Amud Beis says that one of those ideas is greeting people with the name of Hashem. But it says in the Pasuk that when Boaz went out to the field to greet his harvesters, he said to them, Hashem Imochem, Hashem should be with you.
So
right? Well, yeah, it was Sephardic, right? When the Sephardim get an Aliyah, so before they say Baruch Hu, they say Hashem Imochem, except they don't say Hashem, they say the actual word. And then the people answer back, Yivarech Hashem. Just like Boaz and his workers, right? So it says Boaz said Hashem Yimachem. So that's Boaz being representing the earthly Bezin, instituting the idea of greeting your fellow Jew with Hashem's name. And it says the Hashem, the heavenly court agreed with this because we find, get this, when the Malach appeared to Gidon. So the Malach says to Gidon, Hashem imcha gibor achayel. Hashem is with you, O valiant warrior, O valiant soldier. Right? So you see, the Hashem, the heavenly court, agreed to Boaz's ruling that you should greet your friend by saying, by using Hashem's name, by saying, Yivarech Lecha Hashem. Okay? This is the Gemara Mesechus Makos. Now, this Gemara is very problematic if you put it together with what we're saying over here. Because The Marsha asks this question. We're saying that Boaz is Ivtzan, right? Now Ivtzan lived quite a long time after Gidon, right? We have from Gidon till Ivtzan. So we have, you know, Avimelech, we have Tola, Yair, Yiftach, and then Ivtzan, right? We have a good few generations from Gidon to Ivtzan. Now, according to this story, it would seem that according to this Gemara, it would seem that the story of Boaz saying Hashem Imachem to his workers happened before the story of Gidon. Right? That's very difficult because we know that Boaz married Ruth. And then says that he died right after he married her. And so if we're talking about when did this story happen in the lifetime of Boaz, it happened towards the end of Boaz's life. Right? So if it happened at the end of Boaz's life, how could you say that the story of Gidon happened after Boaz said Hashem Imachem, right? In order to show that Hashem holds of greeting your fellow Jew with Hashem's name, right? How could that happen after if Gidon was a judge generations before Ivtzan was a judge? So this is Marshall's question. How could you say that Ivtzan is Boaz? The whole chronology doesn't make any sense anymore. Right? Because Boaz, according to this Gemara, the story of Boaz saying Hashem Imachem happened before Gidon, and Ivtzan happened generations after Gidon. Ivtzan was a judge generations after Gidon.
Must mean Boaz was a very old man.
I know, it's very technical. It's a technical question over here, what we're asking. What are you saying, Shimon?
It just sounds like Boaz was very old.
Fine, but again, however old he was, it doesn't really matter, because this story happened at the end of his life, right? Mm-hmm. Right? because we said that the day he married Ruth, then he died. So if the day that he married Ruth, he died, so then you can't say that Gidon happened after him.
Yes. So we're saying that we learn the halakha from him.
Right. Okay, so you hear the question?
Yeah.
So this is the Marshal's question. So you could take this question as proof to the idea that maybe it's not unanimous that Boaz is Ivtzan. Maybe Boaz is not Ivtzan. Ivtzan is later, and Boaz was lived earlier.
Maybe he's a shul and a different person.
No, but that doesn't help.
I don't care. Okay, fine. It doesn't help. Yeah, I
messed up. So. Okay, so one possible answer would be like what we're saying here, that maybe Ivtzan is not Boaz. Another answer, the Seder Duris suggests that when the Gemara brings this pasuk of Boaz saying Hashem Imachem, so that doesn't mean to refer to this story in Megillas Rus where he met the harvesters and said Hashem Imachem. That's just a scriptural example of Boaz using Hashem's name to greet other people. But he had been doing it his whole life. Right? So earlier in his life, which let's say if he lived a long time, so earlier in his life, which could be before Gidon, he used to say Hashem Imachem. And then we had later on Gidon, where we see that Hashem agrees with his practice of using Hashem's name in greeting people. That's the Seder Adaris' answer. It's not referring specifically to this story of him saying Hashem Yochem. It's referring to him in general having that habit throughout his life. It brings this pasuk because that's the only place where you explicitly see it in Tanakh. That's another answer. A third answer. I saw that the Ben Ish Chai has a sefer on the Gemara called Ben Yehoyada. He says this as an answer to the Marshal's question. I don't quite understand how it answers the question, but he says that the Gemara never really meant to bring proof from Gidon, because it could be that the angel had to say Hashem Imcha Gibor Achayil, Hashem is with you, O valiant soldier, because Gidon would not have been successful with his small army of 300 people unless he had a special blessing from Hashem. So the angel had to do it to give him a special blessing. While on the other hand, when Boaz said it, so Boaz wasn't trying to do anything extra. He was just like, that was why he greeted people. So the Gemara was really bringing its main proof from Boaz, not from Gidon. I don't quite exactly understand how this answers the question, but that's what he says. A fourth answer is...
Well, it answers it because, well, the greeting of Gidon, it's not really a greeting, it's more of a... Well, God's with you.
So how is the Gemara comparing the two then? Like what's the Gemara saying then? The Gemara says we see it by Boaz, and then also we see it by Gidon. So you see that the heavenly court agrees to the earthly court. So where do you see that it agrees? It's not. I don't know. The fourth answer is the Mara Fulda in his parish on the Yerushalmi Mesachas Brachos on Kuf Amid Beis. So he answers a different answer. I was surprised you didn't want to say this, Shimon. We mentioned that there's a medrash that says that when the day that Boaz married Ruth, then he died. Right? So he says, the Mara Fulda wants to argue that the Gemara and Makkos disagrees with that medrash. So the point of contention is not whether Boaz is Ivtzan. No, of course Boaz is Ivtzan. That's what he's going to say. Boaz is for sure Ivtzan. But the machlokas would be, did the story of Ruth happen at the end of Boaz's life, like the Medrash says, that when he married her he died, or did the story of Ruth happen earlier in his life?
Oh, so it could be like all the way before Gidon.
Right. It was earlier in his life before Gidon.
Oh, so it's that whole, well, it's not written chronologically thing again.
Okay. Now, there's a few more interesting points about this. We said that the book of Shoftim starts off, it says, the book of Ruth starts off, Vayhi bimei shvayt ha-shoftim. It was when the judges had judged. Right? Which we said, there is an exegetical interpretation, which means that the judges were judged. But the simple understanding is it was at the time that the judges were judging. Right? So Chazal, in the beginning of Ruth Rabbah, says, who are these judges that were judging? So it brings a machlokas between two opinions. says either it's talking about, actually because the Machlok is in three opinions. Either it's talking about Ehud and Shamgar, which harkens back to episode 2, right? Ehud ben Gera, who the guy who killed Eglon by stabbing him, the fat Eglon in his stomach, right? So that's Ehud, and Shamgar, the guy who was right after him.
Oh, with the tiny dagger.
Yeah, with the tiny dagger. So that's Ehud and Shamgar. So that's the second and third of the judges. So either this story happened then, or the Medrash says it happened in the time of Barak and Devorah. Or it says, or it happened in the time of Devorah, Barak, and Yael, which is the same thing.
Who's the one who killed someone with a tent peg?
What? Devorah was the female Shofet, and Yael was the lady who killed Sisera. Right.
So this is like, what's the difference between like all these things? What? What would be like the difference?
No, the first one, the difference between the first and the second versus the second and third explanations is chronological. When would you place this in the chronology? Would you place this under judges 2 and 3, or would you place it under judge 4? Right?
What's happened during judges?
Right, fine, but exactly when? But then the difference between opinion 2 and 3 is how do you classify this time period? Do you call it the time of Barak and Devorah, or do you call it the time of Devorah, Barak, and Yael?
I guess the earlier it is, the more holy they are.
No, that's not our point. We're trying to understand the chronology, just the from a historical perspective. When did this happen? How do you place the Book of Ruth in terms of the chronology of the Book of Shoftim? Well, we'll see how this is relevant to our discussion of Ivtsan and Boaz. But it's just an interesting point. So what the Medrash is sort of focusing on is that it's a Shvot HaShoftim. So it's sort of a double expression, right? So it's talking about a time of two judges, Shvot and Shoftim, like two judges. So from that it says like, oh, Shamgar and Ehud, or Devorah and Barak, who were sort of co-shoftim in certain ways. And then the third opinion says, no, it's Shvot, which is one, and then Shoftim, which is plural, so that's another two. So that's why three. So that's why he calls it the time of Devorah, Barak, and Yael. But it's interesting to say that Yael was the judge then, because we don't speak about Yael being a judge. We spoke about her sort of seducing Sisera and killing him, right? Giving him some milk to drink and then killing him, but we don't speak about Yael being a judge. But Rashi, in Devorah's song, in Shoftim Perek Hey Pasuk Vav, so in the middle of the song itself says when it happened. It says Bimei Shamgar ben Anas, Bimei Yael, in the days of Shamgar ben Anas, in the days of Yael. And Rashi says from here you see that Yael was also a judge.
How did these other people not have access?
No, that's not the point. The point is how would you classify that time period?
I'm saying like this is like the proof of this this happening in this time period, right? This song.
Yeah.
I'm saying like, how does anybody? What are the other opinions do with this song?
Well, I mean, the song. The first opinion holds that it didn't happen at this time at all. It just happened in the time of Ehud and Shamgar. Right, this song is referring to the victory over Sisera. Right, we're just saying that how would you classify the time period of Devorah and Barak? So would you also call the time period of Yael? That's the difference between the second and third opinion, beginning of Ruth. Okay. I saw something interesting in the parish of the Rokeach. In the to Parshas Bishalach, where it talks about the story of Devorah and Yael. So she gave Sisera milk, right? So somebody asked, what type of milk was it? So I said that the default milk in the Tanakh is usually goat's milk. So I saw one of the Rokeach brings in the name of a Medrash, which we have this Medrash, but the Rokeach brings this, that actually the milk was human milk. What Yael did was she exposed her breasts to Sisera, and she allowed him to drink from herself.
Okay.
So that's I thought you'd find that point interesting. That's why I mentioned it.
All
right. I saw this over Shabbos.
when I first learned that, must be about 10 years ago, I distinctly remember the person who taught it to me saying that he was fed hard cheese and wine. Or am I just getting that mixed up with someone else?
Yeah, there was a similar story in, like, let's say, probably in the Hasmonean period, with somebody with a heroine named Yehudis, who killed the Greek general Helephorns with cheese and wine or something like that. It's a similar story that's sort of modeled after the story of Yael and Sisera.
Okay.
Rashi, in the beginning of Megillas Rus, he dates the story differently. It says, Vayhibish Mishpat Hashoftim. Rashi says, it was in the time of Ivtsan, which equals Boaz. Rashi says, Ivtsan, who is Boaz? Right? And that's when this story happened. Now, a chronological problem is like this. And Rabbi Yitzchak Sorotskin Shlita, in his work, Rinas Yitzchak, points this out. We said that Elimelech's family lived in the land of Moab for 10 years. Right? Now, Ivtsan, we said, it was only a judge for 7 years. Right? Said 7 years. So now, if the story happened in the time of Ivtsan, the famine must have started before the rule or the reign of Ivtsan, because Ivtsan was only judge for 7 years, and they lived there for 10 years. So it must have the whole story really must have started 3 years before Ivtsan became the shofet, if it ended right when he died, right? So that would mean that really the story started in the time of Yiftach, who was the judge right before Ivtsan. But it could be that when Rashi says that this story happened in the time of Ivtsan / Boaz, Rashi is not talking about the beginning of the story. Rashi is talking about the end of the story. Okay, that's a technical point. Okay, a few more technical points about this, and then we'll move on, okay? Because you're getting a little frustrated, I see.
I don't care either way.
You don't care either way?
No, I'm saying I care what's good for you.
Oh, thank you. That was so cliche. Okay. We mentioned way back in episode 2, when we spoke about Eglon, who was killed by Ehud ben Gera, so we said that Ruth was a daughter or granddaughter of Eglon, okay, who was killed by Ehud ben Gera, and that because he stood up when he mentioned that Hashem has a message for him, so he merited to have this very important daughter or granddaughter. Now the problem is that if you look at the date of Ehud ben Gera, right, and you compare it to Ivtsan, you'll come to about 200 years between Ehud ben Gera and Ivtsan, right? From Ehud ben Gera to Ivtsan is about 200 years. If you make the calculation, you have, you know, after Ehud, you have Shamgar and Dvorah, which is 40 years, Gidon, another 40 years, Avimelech, Tola, Yair, Yiftach, all the way down, it comes out a long time. Ehud himself was a shofet for 80 years. It's not clear when during his reign did this story happen, so it comes out to close to 200 years. So now her grandfather or father died 200 years before. How old is she going to be? It's very hard to say that she was still alive in the time of Ivtsan, and she married Ivtsan 200 years later, unless you'll say that no, maybe there's another proof that Ivtsan is not Boaz, so the whole question doesn't start. That's one answer. Another answer you could say is that when we say that Ruth was a daughter or a granddaughter of Eglon, it doesn't literally mean daughter or granddaughter. Rather, it means a descendant of Eglon. And so therefore, she could have been, there's a measure that says that Ruth was only 40 years old when she got married. So if you wanted to say that she was 40 years old, so she couldn't have been a daughter of Eglon if her father died 200 years before. Or you can say another answer, that if you want to disagree with the Medrash that says she was 40 years old, you could say that, yeah, just like Boaz was very old, he was 300 years old or 400 years old according to some Midrashim, so Ruth was also very old. Maybe. Basically what we come out over here is that Chazal tell us that Ivtsan equals Boaz, And what I'm trying to point out is that there's a few inconsistencies over here that make chronological difficulties to say that Ibsen is Boaz, and that maybe there is room to say that Ibsen is not Boaz, and maybe it's not a unanimous.
Is it a machlokas?
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, no, I'm saying it's a machlokas. It's a machlokas.
No, but is it like, do you have like a source anywhere?
There's no explicit source that it's a machlokas, but the evidence that I've brought up over here, I think, points to the notion that. It's likely to be a machlokas.
Okay. Fine.
One of the reasons why you might think that Ivtsan is Boaz is because one of the only facts we know about Ivtsan is that he's from Pes Lachem.
I mean, just because something's like seems a bit off, you know, doesn't mean like you can't meet somebody who's like really smart or explain it all. Like, it's not explicitly machlokas.
Yeah, no, that's why I'm not saying it like with like absolute certainty that it is, but I'm saying that the evidence certainly points in that direction. I think
the evidence points to the fact that you
know. The evidence points. No, it points to the fact that not all Chazalic sources went with this assumption that Boaz is Ibsen. That's what I think it points to. So one of the reasons why you would think that Boaz and Ibsen are the same person is because one of the facts that we know about Ibsen is that he's from Beis Lachem. And we know that Boaz also, in Megillas Rus, we know that Boaz also lived in Beis Lachem. So Beis Lachem, so you say it's the same guy. Okay, that's one of the rationales. And with this, again, we're saying that it would come out that if Ibsen is Boaz, so his Boaz / Ibsen would be from the tribe of Yehuda. Now there's a sefer called Oitzar Shemus, who himself entertains the possibility that maybe Ibsen is not Boaz, and he says that this proof that Beis Lachem is not a proof either, because if you look in the book of Yeshua in chapter 19 verse 15, so it's talking about the tribal territory of Zvulun, and in the tribal territory of Zvulun there's a city called Beis Lachem. So actually what comes out, there's actually two cities, in at least two cities in Eretz Yisrael called Beis Lechem.
What?
Well,
that doesn't, okay.
So in the beginning of Ruth it says Beis Lechem Yehuda. So that's Beis Lechem that's in Yehuda. So Ruth is for sure talking about Beis Lechem in Yehuda. But the Beis Lechem that we're talking about by Ibsen, who says it's talking about Beis Lechem of Yehuda? Maybe it's talking about Beis Lechem in the tribe of Zvulun. And if you learn that Ibsen is not Boaz, it could be that Ibsen is not even from Yehuda, he's from Zvulun.
But wasn't Beis Lachem where Rachel was buried?
Yes, Beis Lachem is where Rachel was buried, correct.
So then how can that be two Beis Lachem?
No, one of the places called Beis Lachem is where Rachel was buried. And you would assume that's the Beis Lachem in Yehuda, because it says in the Pasuk that the Beis Lachem where Rachel is buried is also known as Ephrat, and the Beis Lachem that's in Yehuda is also known as Ephrat. As opposed to the Beis Lachem in Zvulun, that we have no evidence to say that it was also called Ephrat. So what would come out from this is that if Ibsen is not Boaz, it could be that Ibsen is from the tribe of Zvulun. If he is Boaz, then he's for sure from Yehuda. We know the genealogy from Yehuda all the way down to David HaMelech, right? Including Boaz. So that would be undisputable. But if he's not, if Ibsen is not Boaz, you could argue that he's from the tribe of Zvulun.
Is there anyone else who could be from Yehuda?
What?
Is there anyone else who could be from Yehuda for the Shoftim?
Not that I know of. I'm not sure exactly what you're asking.
Because, there's a shofet from
Yehuda. Oh, you're asking, was there another shofet from the tribe of Yehuda?
Yeah, who could be from the tribe of Yehuda.
Yeah, so the first shofet was Osniel ben Knaz, who's from Yehuda. And we also had a shofet named Yair HaGiladi, which, if you understand that Yair HaGiladi is the same person as Yair ben Menashe, it could be that Yair ben Menashe is from the tribe of Yehuda.
So
we already have someone from the tribe of Yehuda, yeah, that's true.
That makes it very unlikely.
So we'll have to speak about that at a different time. Exactly how to understand the Medrash that says that there was a shofet from each tribe, because we're going to see that it doesn't really pan out practically. There was no shofet from the tribe of Reuven, for example, right? And the Medrash explicitly says that there was no shofet from the tribe of Shimon, Even though we argued that maybe Shamgar ben Anas is from Shimon, wasn't clear which tribe Shamgar ben Anas was from, but
the Midrashim are notorious for not being taken literally though.
Fine, but we see the problem is, again, we don't know when to take a Midrash literally and when not to. So unless you have like a good way of understanding it without taking it literally to allegorize it, or you have a tradition that this must be allegorized, I think that the assumption is you have to take it at face value, or at least work with it at face value, and then afterwards you can try to figure out, you know, is it trying to say something deeper than what it's saying at face value.
I thought the default is that it's not at face value.
I think that different people have different ways of looking at it.
Then again, I
have no idea. No, there is such an approach that said that the default is that it's not at face value.
If it wasn't at face value,
right.
Like, by judges, it doesn't mean actual judge. It means every shofet had, whatever tribe had their own, influence on the judges or something like that.
Oh.
So, I'll tell you an interesting theory that I just came up with earlier today. I wanted to suggest that if Ivtsan is not Boaz, maybe Ivtsan is from the tribe of Gad. Okay? Why? Because if you look in Parshas Vayigash, so when the Torah talks about the sons of Gad, so Gad had a son named Etzbon. So Etzbon is spelled the same as Ivtsan, except that the Tzadik and the Beis switch places. So like we said before, that there's this idea that there were certain names that were native to certain tribes.
Yeah.
So like Etzbon to Ivtsan is like not such a switch. So like maybe it was native to the tribe of Gad, and that would work with the Medrash that says that there was a shofet for each tribe. And if you don't say what I'm saying, there is no shofet for the tribe of Gad. That's Ivtsan. So we had three psukim about Ivtsan, and we had a whole share about it. We'll go to the next two judges, hopefully in the next 2 minutes. Okay. Vayishbat Achrav es Yisrael, Elon hazvuloini. After Ivtsan, Elon the Zvulonite judged the Jewish people, and he
definitely from Zvulon.
Yeah, he seems to be definitely from Zvulon. He's our 11th judge, and he was a judge for 10 years. And then it says that Elon hazvuloni died, and he was buried in Ayalon in the land of Zvulon. Yeah.
Does he have a camp that we know?
I don't know. But I'll tell you an interesting thing. This goes back to what we were just saying a second ago. If you look in Parshas Vayigash and Parshas Pinchas, so you look at the descendants of Zvulun. So Zvulun had a son named Elon. Same name. Except that over here, the word Elon is spelled Aleph Yud Lamed Vav Nun. And when this Elon ben Zvulun appears in Chumash, his name is spelled Aleph Lamed Vav Nun, without the Yud. So it's the same name. It's pronounced the same, but it's spelled differently. Elon with a yud, or Elon without a yud. So that's, you know, that goes to the idea that there were certain names that were just like common within the tribes. So here we know he's from Zvulun, and we know that Zvulun had a son named Elon as well. There's another character named Elon in Tanakh. Yeah, you know who is it? You know what I'm talking about? In Parshas Toldos, in the end of Parshas Toldos, it talks about Esav. Esav married a woman named Basmas Bas Elon Hachiti. Basmath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite. So you see there, the name Elon is one of Esav's fathers-in-law. Esav had, how many wives did Esav have? This is a trick question.
Zero.
Well,
zero. I don't know. I'm making it so. I don't know. At least
two Midianites, and at least one other.
So Esav had, first of all, let me tell you a rule, okay? If a rabbi ever asks you a question, the answer is?
You're wrong.
It's a machlokas. So how many wives did Esav had? I said it's a trick question.
Oh.
He had either 3, 4, 5, or 6 wives. That's the answer. I wrote a whole paper about this in Jewish Bible Quarterly a few years back. I think it's called The Wives of Esav by Rabbi Reuben Chaim Klein, Jewish Bible Quarterly. you can see all the details over there. But Esau had this father, one of Esau's fathers-in-law was named Elon the Chittite. Right? So is there a connection between this Elon and that Elon? I would assume not. Although I did find that there's a sefer called Tosfos HaShalem, which is a compendium of different like manuscripts from Tosafists on Chumash. He brings some sort of medrash that says that at some point the prophet Hosea was telling Hashem that maybe he should consider switching out the Jewish people for a different nation, for perhaps the nation of Esav, the descendants of Esav. And he said over there, one of the examples he said is like, switch out Elon the Zvulonite for the children of Basmas Bas Elon, Esav's wife. So it's like some sort of connection. Interesting, like, I don't know. Yeah, it's something you have to develop. You know, I don't know. This is the type of thing you wouldn't take literally. This is the type of thing you have to see. Like, okay, what's like the thematic connection between there? Why is this instead of this? But
what does the name Elon mean? That might be interesting.
I think that the name Elon Musk. Right?
Yeah, I think that. So
that's his name.
Yeah.
I believe it means an oak tree. So you can develop that for a little bit further.
The oak tree is there,
powerful. You don't have to say anything now. You think about it.
Okay.
So that was our 11th our 11th judge. Now we go to the 12th judge. V'yish menachem v'yis Yisrael Avdon ben Hillel ha-pirasoni. After him, the judge of Israel, his name was Avdon, the son of Hillel, the Pirathonite. And he had 40 sons. And he had 30 grandsons. Who rode on 70 ponies or 70 special types of donkeys.
Boom.
And he judged the Jewish people for 8 years.
Wait, why is it telling us that his kids and grandkids rode donkeys?
Because it's so rich, because,
so yeah, that's
very valuable.
So hopefully we'll speak about this on Wednesday. I have a whole explanation about it by one after we finish the book of Judges, basically on Tuesday. So on Wednesday we're going to have a more retrospective way of looking back at it and drawing out certain ideas, and with that perspective, after having seen the whole Sefer, we can understand a little bit better why it's mentioning that he had so many sons and grandsons and that he had all these donkeys. But the point more or less is
typically people who have a lot of kids.
The point of it is to show that he's very rich and that he was from a very important family. That's more or less the point.
I mean, at least in ancient times, right?
Yeah. So Avdon was the judge. He's our 12th judge, and he was the judge for 8 years. And it says that he died and he was buried in a place called Pirason, which is in the land of Ephraim. And most authorities take the assumption that Avdon ben Hillel is from the tribe of Ephraim. So he's our only Shofet from Ephraim, by the way. There actually is also a place called Pirason or Pirasoni, which is associated with Binyamin, but for some reason the Mefarshim don't get into that. So that's Avdon ben Hillel, the Pirasoni. He's our 12th Shofet. Now this title, Ha Pirasoni, spelled like this, just so you can. Hey, Pei, Reish, Ayin, Saf, Vav, Nun, Yud, Ha Pirasoni. So the shoresh of this word Pirasoni, you would assume, is the word para, which means to pay back.
Yes.
Right? Like in Aramaic or in Talmudic Hebrew means like to pay back a loan. So V'ramami Panu, Menachem Azariah of Fanu, he writes in his Sefer Gilgul Neshamos that this Avdon ben Hillel HaPironi, he says, he paid back his forefather's debt to the Jewish people. Not sure exactly what that means, but he refers to a specific story that when the Jewish people were in Egypt, so some members of the tribe of Ephraim decided that they're just going to leave Egypt and go back to Eretz Yisrael. This is before the Exodus.
Weren't they just a pile of bones in the desert?
And then what happened was that they left and they went up along the coast to go into Eretz Yisrael, and they were attacked by Philistines in the city of Gath, and they were destroyed. And they all died. So according to the Ramami panel, this Avdon ben Hillel HaPirasani was paying back their debt to the Jewish people, those Ephraimites that died. I'm not sure exactly what the debt is that he's referring to, but he's sort of a tikkun. He's a reincarnation of some of those people, I guess, and he's trying to rectify their averas. And he was the 12th judge of the Jewish people, and he was the judge for, as we mentioned before, 8 years. Now, after he died, it says, "Vayosifu bnei Yisrael la'aseis hara b'enei Hashem." This is the beginning of chapter 13 in Judges. After he died, the Jewish people continued to do bad in the eyes of Hashem. "Vayitnei Hashem b'yad plishtim arboim shana," and Hashem gave them to the hands of the plishtim for 40 years. Right. So now we're transitioning to the plishtim being the main enemy of the Jewish people. We've come across the plishtim before. We've come across the plishtim before in the book of Judges, but they haven't been the main player. For example, way back in Judge number 2, Shamgar ben Anas, so we said that Shamgar ben Anas killed 600 plishtim with a cattle prod.
What is
Philistine.
What does it mean?
It's a name of a nation. Well, the Sharish Pei Lamed Shin means something that's open. Like there's a concept called a mavay or mafulish. If you have an alleyway that's open from one end to the other, you can like just walk straight through. Or if you have if you have an esrog that has a hole in it and the hole goes from one end to the other end, it's like a complete hole. So it's called mafulish. So Pei Lamed Shin is like, it means like something that it goes through entirely.
I heard from like an Israeli that plishtim means invaders, and that Palestinian comes from that word. So in the name, they're invaders. I don't know if he's correct or not. That's what he was trying to sell me.
I mean, in English, if you look in like Webster's dictionary, you look up the word Philistine, it's like an uncouth, bellicose person. You know, like a person who's combative and tries to like fight and is like a warrior, because that's one of the pictures you get of the Philistines. And where exactly the Philistines came from and when did they conquer their area is very interesting thing how it works out in history.
Like Greek origins?
It could be that they were like Phoenician and Philistines. If they know exactly what the relationship between them were, like how it pans out. So, anyways, we already came across the plishtim. In the time of the second judge, Shamgar ben Anas, who killed 600 plishtim with a cattle prod. And then we had, again, the plishtim in the time of Yiftach. It says that before Yiftach came about, so it says that the Jews were doing bad in the eyes of Hashem, and Hashem sold them to the plishtim and to the Ammonites. They said that they were surrounded by enemies. They had, to their east, they had the Ammonim, who were their enemies, and to their west was the plishtim. And Yiftach only conquered the Ammonim, but we don't see that Yiftach really had to deal with the plishtim so much. The plishtim weren't a major force then. But now, after the death of Avdon ben Hillel, it seems that the plishtim are going to be the dominating force over the Jewish people. And it's the Ramban in Parshas Vayechi says that none of the shoftim are going to be able to completely defeat the plishtim. None of the shoftim were able to subdue or have a victory over the plishtim. None of them. The only exception is, as we're going to see tomorrow, that Shimshon started to defeat the plishtim.
We're doing Shimshon tomorrow.
Tomorrow we're starting Shimshon. Shimshon wasn't able to finish off the deed. It's gonna only happen after the Jewish people establish a kingdom. Okay. I think we'll stop over here.
All right.